We're up to Parshat Mishpatim. Ordinarily, we do an overview of the parsha. This parsha is so loaded, we'll just plow through it, okay? The parsha will cover many laws, primarily monetary laws. The idea of a justice system is imperative. The judges are called Elohim. The word Elohim means one who has force, but Elohim also means God. And the judges have a responsibility to represent God in the world. In other words, God created a world with a commandment to have a justice system. God is saying, I won't interfere every time one person steals from the other, but I leave it up to you to set up a system that will interfere. So there has to be a system that represents the fairness of God in the world. That system is the justice system. And so the justice system is called Elohim, the forceful ones, but also those that are supposed to represent God in the world. We have a tradition that a justice system here in Israel that will work based on the laws of the Torah will have God's presence in their midst. On the one hand, they can err. On the other hand, we assume it won't happen because God is helping them get it right. Have they erred? Yes. Does the Torah say they can err? Yes. And nonetheless, we expect them to be on a higher level and get as close as possible to the truth. The Torah describes the judges and the justice system, the Ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihim. These are the rules and justices that the judiciary system that you will place before them. That word Lifneihim teaches us many halachot. Number one, when a Jew has a legal issue with someone else, they should try to bring them before a Jewish court. Lifneihim, go before them, don't go to an external court. It is complex. Sometimes the courts can make it easier for you because the courts will sometimes say, if El Al tricked you on a deal, as happened to someone here in the yeshiva, it wasn't El Al, it was the travel agent, but the agent tricked the person. So he tried to take him to a Jewish court. The person wasn't interested in coming. So the courts will sometimes give you a notice that says, being that so-and-so is not coming before us, we hereby tell you, go to the secular court. The secular court in Israel is no different than a secular court in any other country. It does not go by the laws of the Torah. So we have the same concept. We're supposed to work with the laws of the Torah. We're supposed to go before a Jewish justice system. Ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lifneihim. Place it before them. So here Moshe was told to explain the Torah to the judges so that they can have a grasp and understanding. They don't just know laws, they also understand the reasoning behind it. Our first law is about an Eved Ivri. There are two types of Avadim Ivrim. A person can see that he's losing all his assets and then he could sell himself into slavery. By doing so, he benefits that the master takes over the finances of his family, feeds his wife and kids, gives him a good bed, gives him good food. The Torah developed this as a social welfare system. When a person cannot take care of themselves anymore, so then they can sell themselves. They are responsible to be a servant. They have to work. But on the other hand, all their needs are taken care of. The master is responsible to give him medical care and food and whatever he needs. So this is a great system. The guy is absolved of responsibility. On the other hand, he has to work. It's not like he could stay in bed and say, let the system feed me. His wife, his kids, they're all taken care of. It's not what the Torah wanted. The Torah wanted a person to be free. One of the issues our generation has is that we don't like freedom because freedom gives responsibility. Oh, we're fanatics over freedom. Except when we aren't. There are many things we'd like freedom. But in big things, we don't want freedom. When a person has to decide who they're going to marry, what job they're going to take, what master's they're going to get in college, they want someone else to decide for them. People postpone decisions. People run away from that responsibility. Or they go to gurus who will tell them what to do with their lives because people are scared of it. The Torah wanted us to make decisions. That's what a living person does. They analyze, they can take counsel, but they take responsibility and they make decisions. And so the Torah put the first mitzvah as the mitzvah of how a man goes back into freedom. Because one of the things the Torah laments, so to speak, is this idea that a person will lose their freedom. So the first mitzvah is, how does he regain his freedom? So this person, even though he's given up on life's freedoms, he's let someone else make his decisions for him, the Torah says he can do that for up to 6 years. irrespective of when Shemitah falls out, on the seventh year he goes free. If he is married, so then the master no longer has to support his wife after those 6 years. If he is married, then the master can tell him, look, I have these non-Jewish female slaves. By day you'll work in the field, and by night I want you to help me procreate and develop the family of the Shifcha Knaanit. Now that's something which is complicated, because the guy is married, he has a wife back home, and here he's being told which woman he should be with every night. That's not as much fun as a person might think. Chazal say that the servants actually liked this. There were servants who didn't want to go free, because here every night they could be somewhere else. That can be understood. But again, that reminds us of which type of person would actually enter the system of losing their freedom, leaving their families, being a servant to someone else. It's not an ideal situation. But the Torah deals with the bottom rung first, with the guy who is finished. He has no food to eat. His children are walking around hungry. There's a danger of what will happen as his children are roaming the streets looking for food. And who knows who will take those children, give them food. So the Torah is concerned first for this guy and his children. And the Torah sets up a system where this guy is taken care of, his wife and kids are taken care of, and we don't have to worry what will happen with him. If at the end of those 6 years he says, you know what, life's pretty good here, I don't want to go back home, I'd rather stay with this woman, I'd rather stay with these kids. So there's a special mitzvah of Eved Mirza, where the master puts a hole, he takes him to court, and they make a hole through the ear, and then he can remain until the end of the Yovel, until the Yovel, the Jubilee year.
Is there a reason why they pierce the ear?
Yep, there is. One understanding is that the ear that hurt, God's declaration that you're supposed to be my servants, and that ear went ahead and said, I'd rather have a different master. That ear gets pierced. Now here again we have depth. Being God's servant is being a free man. Because man will always pursue something. So if I'm pursuing the material world, I'm a slave to those desires. I'm a slave to what society thinks of me. Do I have the latest app, iPhone,
house,
right? So when God gave us the Torah, he took the words out of my mouth. When God gave us the Torah, he gave us a gift of freedom. When God says, you are my servants, what God is saying is, I've taken you and I'm going to give you the formula of making life meaningful. The Torah gives us a mitzvah that the Torah hates. The capacity of a father to sell his daughter. And the Torah really views it as a curse. Meaning, the Torah says, who's going to sell a guy to his daughter? It's someone who has to worry that he's so destitute that his daughter might end up being a woman of ill repute. He doesn't want her out on the streets. He cannot take care of her. So the Torah says, we will give him a capacity of taking care of his daughter. She'll get decent wages. She'll be working in someone's house. And she'll have the capacity to move up the social ladder. Because here she is in this guy's house. This guy's wealthy enough to support her and take care of her. Chances are she's going to learn etiquette. She's going to learn how decent people behave. She will be clothed. She'll be taken care of. She'll have a warm bed. She'll have a warm house. And every day, the guy who purchased her is going to see her. She's going to work for 6 years or until she matures. Either or. What happens is she becomes a part of the family. Even though she's serving everyone, but she's a part of the family. And then, either the owner or his son have a mitzvah to marry her. The Torah gives them a mitzvah where the Torah says, the money you purchased her with is already kiddushin money. It's as if the Torah is saying, you bought her, you're married to her. If you choose not to marry her, then she'll go out. The Torah sets it up as though step one has already been accomplished. It's like when two people were supposed to go on a date. So the mother of the girl was very smart. And she said, you know, why don't you guys just do me a favor and go pick up this thing? And she sends them out on this long, wild goose chase to pick up whatever it was. The car unfortunately breaks down, even though she knew it would break down. They end up spending like 15 hours together until they get back. And she did all this so that by the end of those 15 hours, they're good friends. She won. So the Torah says to the guy, just take her and she'll serve you in your house, and you and your son are already engaged to her. If you choose not to, you don't have to. It's like when they call you and say, first month free of charge, right? They offer you all these deals. We'll take your credit card information and you could cancel at any time. But your first month is free. Golan did this, right? Golan gave you 3 months free and you could cancel after those 3 months. How many people cancel? Once you're in, you're in. Yeah. So the Torah says, you're engaged to her, but you could cancel at any time. If you choose to marry her, you've already given her kiddushin money. The Torah says, if you do marry the girl, you have to treat her like any other girl. You can't look down at her and say, oh, she was the maid. No. Once you married her, then she gets equal status like any other wife. And then the Torah describes what status, what does that mean? It means you have to buy her clothing. It means you have to give her time. It means you have to be intimate with her. It means that you have to ensure that she's well taken care of. So from here we learn what a husband is obligated to his wife. You have to have time together. You have to be intimate. You have to give her clothing. You have to give her food. You have a responsibility as a husband. You know, people get married and they don't understand what it says in the Ksuba. So people have all kinds of modern concepts. But what it really says in the Ksuba is that you are responsible, as the Ksuba says, umiglimai dal ktefai, down to the shirt on my back, it says in the Ksuba. I am taking responsibility to take care of this woman. So the Torah describes it, again, when the Torah describes the underling, the Torah wants to describe the guy who's down on the bottom, even her, you're not allowed to go short on your minimum responsibilities to your wife. And this is where we learn a man's responsibilities to his wife. The Torah tells us that if a person kills, he gets a death penalty. Obviously, if they intended to do it, and if there were witnesses and there was warning. And then the Torah gives us the mitzvah of ir miklat. If a person kills unintentionally, they can run away to a city of refuge. The Torah tells us, people sometimes think if they're busy in the service of God, then that allows them to do immoral activities. And the Torah will reiterate over and over again that that doesn't work. You cannot steal and then give the money to the temple. Ah, I'm a Madoff. I donated so much money. Right. It doesn't make what you did kosher. And so the Torah says, if a person killed and they're busy sacrificing on the altar, take him off the altar. Don't even delay it and say, he's busy sacrificing. How could we disturb him? No. Take him down and judge him fairly. We don't give, we don't exonerate anyone just because they're a servant of God. And the Torah will say, a woman who's a woman of ill repute, she cannot take the gifts that she's given and give them as dedications to the temple. The same idea. She'll sometimes think, you know, I'm not such a bad person. Look at what I'm doing. I'm being a holy person, says the Torah. No, that doesn't work. We have a biblical prohibition. One may not hit their father, wound their father, punishable by the death penalty. The challenge comes when a person is a doctor. So then if they have to operate on their father or they're a dentist. So ordinarily we recommend that find someone else in your profession and make a deal. You'll take care of his debt and he'll take care of your debt. Because it's very hard to be careful and not cause a person to bleed or drop more than necessary. And if one did that, that's a biblical prohibition. It's wrong for any doctor to cause bleeding more than necessary. But with one's father, there's an added stringency, a father or a mother. So if there's no other doctor who can do the job as well, then one does take care of one's parent, obviously. We have the biblical prohibition of kidnapping, punishable by the death penalty. We have the biblical prohibition of cursing one's parents with God's name. So that's an important prohibition. Some of the commentaries point out how these mitzvos really are the details of the Ten Commandments. And if you look closely, you'll see how all these mitzvos line up with the Ten Commandments. The simple way is you just say, well, the Torah said don't steal. So now the Torah is telling you what you're legally entitled to. Right? That's all the monetary matters.
Don't steal is kidnapping, I heard.
Okay.
All those negative commandments on the death penalty, obviously stealing wouldn't give you the death penalty, but kidnapping would.
Okay. The Torah tells us that if one wounds his friend, he must pay nezek, the damages. So we evaluate what could this person have accomplished before he was afflicted and after. So how do we evaluate that? We say if he were sold on the slave market. So if the guy is a top computer programmer, and now they cut off his two hands, so he can't program computers as well. So now, if you want to evaluate his diminished value, you evaluate how much would someone pay for such a servant? A servant who could be a computer programmer and rake in $250,000 a year. So you'd pay for such a servant $500,000 shekel, $1 million shekel, because you figure over the years you're going to make it back and more. Now he doesn't have his two hands. What would you pay for the guy? You'd pay $10,000 shekel for him. So that's how you evaluate. Okay, so the damage you inflicted on this person, you diminished his value by a few million shekel. So that's nezek. Tsar, you have to pay for the person's pain. How do we evaluate that? We say, well, if you had to undergo that procedure with anesthesia or without, how much would you pay for the anesthesia? So we evaluate, how much would an average person pay for undergoing that with anesthesia as opposed to without? I once had a dentist ask me that. It's interesting.
How much would you?
I didn't know. It's like I don't like pain. Right? I had a hard time figuring out. Like drilling in your tooth can be really painful. I always ask myself, where would I draw the limit? I don't know. How much would you pay?
If I could reference it to a pain.
I'm saying, yeah, think about it. You chew on a tooth, you feel the pain. Now they're going to drill there.
Okay.
Without anesthesia, right. How much would you pay for the anesthesia?
If one guy hits another guy, and he punches out one of his tooth.
That's the eye for an eye, monetary.
Well, then you have to calculate how much you would be willing to get this tooth taken out without a pain.
Correct.
Right? As if it was the super perfect, strong and healthy.
Doesn't matter. We evaluated damages, question number one. Then aside from that, you have to pay for the pain, nezek tsar. Then sheves, you have to pay for all the time that he was unemployed, all the time that he couldn't work. And then ripui, you have to pay for his medical bills. And then boshes, you have to cover his shame. So sometimes it's an embarrassment. Someone walks up to you and smacks you across the face. It's embarrassing. Aside from the pain, there's the embarrassment. So we evaluate each of those depending on who's giving the smack, who's receiving the smack, the front of the hand, the back of the hand, right? So those are the components of damages that we evaluate when a person has harmed someone else. Here we have the pasuk that was referenced earlier, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Maimonides writes in the introduction to Mishnah that it's our tradition. No one contests this. Our tradition tells us that it doesn't literally mean an eye for an eye. You look at the pasuk, you wouldn't know that. It's the tradition that tells you that's not what it means. It means you evaluate the monetary value. The Torah tells us if a person causes his servant to lose an eye or a tooth, so then they go free. So this is a warning to the owner. You bought a non-Jewish servant. And now you think, hey, I could tell him to do whatever I want. And if he doesn't listen, I pick up the stick. Says the Torah, yeah, think twice. First of all, the courts can get involved if you're abusive. And secondly, if you do cause him to lose an eye or a tooth or something like that, he goes free. So the Talmud has a few funny stories where the servants knew this. And the servant would tell the master, I have this terrible pain here. Could you give me a hand? And the master would take a look and the servant would pull his head back and he'd say, you took out my tooth and go free. Servants took advantage of this. But that's not halacha. Any one of the 24 limbs, like a finger, the tip of the... Right, okay, so the eye...
Could you steal from Robin Hood? Could you steal from thieves and give it to the poor?
That's a good question that deserves a long answer. We have the responsibility of watching over our animals. So first there's the responsibility that our animals shouldn't harm someone else. And one has to pay if they do. Then there's the responsibility. You're not allowed to let your animals scare other people. So if you have a scary dog, he has to be chained up in a way that everyone knows he can't hurt them. They had this thing, I don't know if they still do, they had these like sound fields where if a dog tried to pass the yard, he'd hear such a wailing sound that he'd run back into the yard. They have like these fences where you don't see the fence, But the dog knows he can't go beyond a certain point. So, halachically, that's not kosher. Because it's not only the question of, will the dog inflict harm or not? There's a question, what does the guy walking by feel like? You're not allowed to leave a dog that scares people. So, of course, you're also not allowed to let your dog walk around. People say, you know, he's harmless, right? Except for when he isn't. Yeah. We have a responsibility if we either uncover a pit or see a pit uncovered. So that's something where people could fall in and hurt themselves. So we have to understand that it applies not only to a pit. You're walking down the street and you see glass broken on the street. I was once walking, taking my kids to school, and there was a construction site with a pit that was at least 10 meters deep. They were laying foundations, so it was very deep. And the fence that was supposed to protect people from slipping in had shifted by about a foot, half a foot. But that's enough for a kid to fall in. So I called the area, and I stayed there for about an hour and a half to watch over that pit until they came to fix it, because halachically, you can't leave a danger zone open. Sometimes there's an open wire. People sometimes see, we had it here in the library, where the place where you turn on the light and off the light, so right next to it was an electric box that was open. So what happens if in the dark a guy means to turn on the light, only he shifted to the next one, right? You're not allowed to do that. So you have to take care of it. You see something that's a potential harm to the public, you have to deal with it. Even on Shabbos, we have special leniencies where we say if you see something dangerous, so even though it's muktzeh, you're allowed to take it and move it so kids don't get hurt or adults don't get hurt. And this applies in your home. Sometimes you'll see a shekel on the floor on Shabbos. If you have a toddler that's crawling around, for that toddler, it's dangerous. It's not only the situation where the pit that's described in the halacha, it's other situations as well. We have the mitzvah of watching over our energy. The Torah speaks about fire, and we apply it not only to fire, but other energy as well. You can't let your energy harm other people. So a person has a ham radio, and they live in an apartment building. They want to put the antenna on the top floor, and then they're going to use high frequency. So they're frying the brain of the guy on the top floor. You know, there are limits to how high frequency, how much energy you could have going through the antenna. And this is all the idea of being careful with our energy. Not only the fire, we have other applications as well. It's interesting that when the Talmud discusses all of this, the Talmud discusses high-level physics. The Talmud discusses vector forces. That when you shoot an arrow, there's the force pushing up, there's the force pushing forward. And as the arrow goes down, your force keeps propelling it forward, but now it's gravity that's pulling it downward. So how do I break down your role in the damage and gravity's role in the damage? The Talmud actually goes into that discussion. So these halachos are actually broken down to great detail, and it's very interesting. If you learn it and you start analyzing it in today's modern day, you see that there's a lot of relevance to today. It's not just a historical halachos about oxen and fire in a pit. Those are the prototypes from which we derive. We boil them down to their natures, and then we learn how to apply them in other instances. We have a special halacha that says that if a person is digging into someone's house and he's there on his way to steal, and then the homeowner wakes up, hears the guy digging into his house, pulls out his machete, and as the guy walks in through the, you know, he's dug in, he sticks in his head, so the homeowner hacks it off. So now the halacha says he's not held liable, because we assume that whenever someone's coming to rob you, they realize that you might wake up. And if you wake up, then you're not going to stand idly by and say, sure, take whatever you want. On the contrary, you're going to stand up and put up a fight. That means that any robber is prepared to kill. They're coming in with the knowledge that they might enter a fight, and then they're prepared to kill. So that's why it's considered a danger. From here we learn the halacha that if someone's coming to kill you, so get up an hour earlier and kill them first. And the same halacha applies to damages. You got to teach it to the kids. If someone's coming to hit you, so you pop them in the nose first. Don't let them get the first sock in. The halacha says, just like someone who's coming to kill you, kill him first. If someone's coming to hit you, so you get in the first punch, so he doesn't get his punch in at you.
I wish I knew that. Well, it's amazing.
But you got to be sure. You got to be sure that he's really going to punch you, right?
And you got to be willing to take a beating once in a while, because he's even bigger than you.
I'm sorry, sir. Did you intend on punching me?
Yes.
But the Torah says that there are instances where you know he wouldn't have killed you. Like if it's a father coming to steal from the son, so then even though he might want the son's money, he wouldn't have killed the son. So then if the son knew it was his father, then he's not allowed to kill the robber coming in. Interesting. It doesn't say the flip is true. It doesn't say the inverse is true.
If the son comes
to the father, the father better be careful for his life.
Because your father will die, then Rashi asks, but there's not been a 10 fully grown sons at this point. Why do you say about the sons? Because you know that father loves the son, because Adam Rishon was inherently born without. It's innate in us that a father loves the son more than the son.
Very nice that the Talmud words it. The father's love is focused to his son. And the son's love is focused to his sons. Each one's focused onward. Yeah. The Torah tells us if someone steals an object, they have to pay double. There's a special halacha. If one steals a sheep or an ox and they slaughter it or sell it, then they pay four times the sheep, five times the ox. We're told we have to watch what our animals eat. You can't let your animal go grazing and eating other things that belong to other people. And if one does, they have to pay back. And here the Torah teaches us that when one inflicts damage, they have to pay top quality. You could tell the guy, you know, I know I owe you money. I know I owe you 50 grand. Look, every Shabbos I drink a little bit of wine. I have the glass bottles at the end of Shabbos. They're worth 30 agorot. I'll put together 50,000 glass bottles for you. That'll be the first installment. I'll pay you slowly but surely. So technically, you are giving him something that has a monetary value. So we have halachos. When do you have to pay top dollar? When do you have to pay middle dollar? And when can you pay bottom dollar? There are different halachot. And sometimes, oh, you guys are learning this in Bava Metzia. You guys know this. Okay, good. So we don't have to go into that. Okay.
We'll be taught it. That doesn't mean we learned
it. We're learning Bava Kama.
Yeah, okay, very good. The Torah gives us a mitzvah. If we find a lost object, we have to give it back. The Torah gives us responsibilities. If you borrow an object, you're responsible. That you can't say, yeah, I'm sorry, the robbers came in and stole it. Okay, so you got to pay. You borrowed, you got to pay. The Torah gives us hefty responsibility for a person who borrowed. What happens if someone, he's running into Mincha and he says, keep an eye on my laptop for me. Okay, so you keep an eye on his laptop for him. And then you're standing there sipping your tea as you keep an eye on it. Suddenly you choke, you didn't go down the right side, and you start coughing, and before you notice it, you spill on his laptop. And now his laptop's dead. So you're responsible.
Even if you weren't guarding.
Even if you weren't guarding, right? So when a person takes responsibility, even if it's not serious responsibility, they're shomer chinam. They cannot be negligent. You have responsibility. You can't be negligent. What if they're paying you something for your responsibility? Then you have more responsibility. Where does this come up? You're flying to the States and someone asks you to bring something. You're flying back, someone asks you to bring something. So then you're, very often you're a shomer chinam. You're watching over it, you're not charging them. And yeah, you can't be negligent. We have a mitzvah not to allow a witch to live. So what's a witch? Why doesn't it say a warlock? The same would be true for a warlock. I mean, you warn them and you tell them this is biblically prohibited and punishable by the death penalty. Now this has two approaches, which we will see throughout the Torah. Whenever we deal with these mitzvos that pertain to sorcery or the like, so the generally accepted approach is maybe Nachmanides' approach, that there are forces out there and you could tap into them. And then you have Maimonides' approach, which was also the approach of some of the Gaonim, that said, this is all a lie. All these different warlocks and sorcerers and witches, They're all a bunch of charlatans. They know how to con you and make you think like they have forces. And the common folk believe it, but really there's nothing to it.
Since when, Rabbi? There was a time when it definitely was.
No. The Rambam learns there never was a time that any of these people had any power.
What about Pharaoh's children? Anyone could turn sticks?
So that's... They knew how to sleight of hand. I know how to make a handkerchief turn into a staff, and a staff turn into a handkerchief, and into a snake, and everything else. It's all sleight of hand.
It always has to be a balance. When a Sunday could do a big miracle, so to speak, so could the Goyim could do. It has to be a balance. Now there's
right.
Nothing of either.
But maybe they could do it with sleight of hand. That's the machlokas.
Sadiq as well?
No. The Navi could do a real miracle, and the sorcerer or whatnot is going to do sleight of hand. Right? So the Rambam learns that was all hallucination and games, and she knew, the Rambam learns that she knew that Saul was dead scared of this fight, and so she made it all up. The Rambam, that's how the Rambam, it's not even his own opinion, this is the opinion of the Gaonim.
They were just trickery.
Right.
Doesn't Rashi state in Sanhedrin that there were, I think, 80 witches where the
difference of opinion is what
tall people so come in?
Rashi is like the Ramban is like Rashi, where Rashi seems to say there are forces out there. So you come to this, the prohibition in the Torah that a witch gets the death penalty. The Rambam's going to learn that it's a prohibition against doing all these tricks, causing people to think you have all kinds of strengths. And the Ramban is going to learn, no, there was once this real wisdom, and they knew how to tap into these forces and how to apply them. Why does it speak about a witch and not a warlock? Because women have a greater tendency to be interested in alternative medicine and things that are less rooted in logic. You see it till today. No, I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm saying there's a... call it holistic, whatever. That's why you see that there are many more men who are learning engineering. Yeah, that works with the male mind. Law. As much as they're doing affirmative action, you still see there are many more men in law than women. Because at the end of the day, that's what fits the male mind. Let me see, 1 + 1, I could do building blocks. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Women approach life in a different way, and that way has its strengths and its weaknesses, just like men's approach has its strengths and weaknesses. So in this area, the Torah warns the women more, even though it's an equal prohibition to the men, because it's more common that they'll be attracted to it, because in certain respects, it jives with them better than it does with us. You see that till today. I think for every guy you have in holistic medicine, you have 10 women selling and promoting and singing the praises of holistic medicine. Okay.
I mean, one thing it says about the kinim, only one tefach underground, black magic doesn't go smaller than this size.
There are a lot of questions, right? You're right. There are a lot of questions, and the Rambam explains how he understands some of them, and he doesn't explain all of them, right? The Torah warns us that we have to focus our sacrifices on Hashem, and the Torah again warns us to be kind to the ger. Special commandment, you may not afflict the ger. Torah tells us, lo tone. What does it mean, lo tone? It means don't say something that might hurt him. So if one would say, what was it like eating a cheeseburger? He doesn't feel comfortable talking about it. And I think the same would hold true, even though it's not the biblical commandment, with a chozer b'tshuva, right? But if one does it to chozer b'tshuva, he transgresses only a few biblical prohibitions. If one does it to ger, he transgresses many more biblical prohibitions. If one is going to invite someone over for a Shabbos meal, so all things being equal, if one choice is a Jew who's from birth, or Chozer B'tshuva, and the other choice is a ger, all things being equal, he should choose the ger, because he's getting many more mitzvot. The Torah gives us many, many more mitzvot about doing things kindly to a ger. So that's a commandment that will reiterate itself throughout the Torah. The Torah then goes on to warn us about the widow and the orphan. Now, the juxtaposition of the ger with the almana and yatom is because of something very simple. The almana and yatom, the widow and the orphan, are lacking the basic breadwinner in their lives. Their father or husband isn't there. The ger who has to switch to a new country, to a new culture, to a new territory where he doesn't own land and he doesn't have land that's in the family possession. He doesn't have the contacts. So he's starting from ground up. And that's why very often gerim were not so well to do. It took a long time until a ger, his children or his grandchildren, got settled. And this is true even for people who move just without converting. You move from one country to another, it's very hard to get your footing. You don't know the ins and outs of how to take advantage and not be taken advantage of by the legal system, by the social system. There are a lot of tricks that you learn as you stay in a country. For example, many Israelis will have their business on their wife's name. Perfectly legal, only you have much less taxes. There are little games you can play that make a world of a difference, and they're legal. Legitimate. The government knows you're doing it. We once opened a sfarim store, and we came to list the sfarim store, and the guy behind the counter in the Israeli IRS said, "You're not doing it on your name, you're doing it on your wife's name." You know, he gave us that counsel. Said, "Why should you pay more taxes? It's perfectly legal. Put it under her name." So there are ins and outs, and it's harder. It's harder to get good footing. So there's a special mitzvah to be careful. Yes. I'm sorry, just to be careful not to hurt the person's feelings. Yeah.
Does it also apply to marriage? It says to be, because I know today with the gerers, a lot of them have hard times getting married because there's a little bit of a discrimination that people who were born Jewish don't necessarily want to marry a ger. So, I don't know, I have a few friends who are having lots of issues with this. And does that transgress this a lot? Because it says to treat them with respect, but not necessarily to marry them.
I'll tell you a story. Okay? We had a student here in the Machon. He converted to Judaism, and he dated a wonderful, wonderful girl. They dated for a period, and then they got engaged. They didn't publicize their engagement. They were going to publicize it the next morning. And right after they agreed they were getting engaged, she said to him, "You know, I still haven't come to terms with the fact that you're a ger."
What?
And they called me up and asked me, what should they do? And I said, don't get married. The greatest achievement that you have is that you converted. You made the greatest move a person can make in their life. And if she has to come to terms with that, then you're not talking the same language. If she can look at you and say, wow, I'm marrying someone so amazing who actually did such a thing in their life, great, then we could talk. But if she's saying she has to come to terms with it, and now she's saying she's not yet sure if she came to terms with it, how could you get married? I have no issue with the girl. Maybe it's her upbringing, maybe it's her parents, maybe it's her school. I don't know. I'm not coming to blame her. She's a very good girl. I'm just saying, you're asking a question as if it would be in the ger's interest to marry someone who has an issue with the fact that they're a ger. I wouldn't recommend that. No. I think that, I told you guys, the first time I met a ger, I was so excited, I ran to a payphone to call my parents. I was here in the Jewish quarter. I called my parents and said, "You won't believe what I saw today." Saying, you know, there's something amazing.
A lot of gays are more religious than Jews by birth. I mean, you know,
that's not the question. I'm saying, but if you meet someone who doesn't have that appreciation, so then. With all due respect, I don't think it's in your interest to marry that person, and they could be a wonderful person. But that's not a shidduch that I think makes sense.
Boaz married. The shidduch comes from a ger, right?
Right. So you don't have to convince me. I'm just saying this.
Yeah, well, Moshe Rabbeinu, I mean, he marries the daughter of Yitro.
Right.
But they say people gave David a hard time. So it's not anything new. Some people do that.
Right? You see, even with Ruth, her first shidduch didn't want her. Right? There was a closer relative, and he said, "No, I'm worried about this." Okay. So I said, look what he lost out on. And every year we read about his bad move. Every year comes Shavuos, we read it. Poor guy. He's remembered. That's how he's remembered for all of history. Okay, but like Aviel is saying, so you see that this has been an issue throughout our history. I would add a point, which I didn't want to say, but once you brought that example proves it. You usually find that the less learned people are, the more they're inclined to discriminate. It's unfortunate, but people find Gerim usually encounter the greatest discrimination when they enter arenas where people are not so observant, not so learned, and then that's where Gerim will often encounter that, and it's unfortunate. We have a mitzvah to give loans. The Torah tells us if you give a loan to someone who's poor, you have to be careful not to afflict them, not to hurt them, not to take interest, not to treat them like, when are you going to pay me? When are you going to pay me? You know, make sure every morning you walk by his house just so he sees you on the way there and back. So we have a mitzvah to give loans. And on the other hand, we have to be kind to the person who took the loan. The flip side is you don't have to be stupid. You know, a person comes for a loan, so there's no reason you should give a loan without knowing who the person is and taking collateral. Every few years we have here in the Machon some character who takes loans and then disappears. We don't know what country he's in. Like, he's gone. And people have lost thousands of euros and dollars and shekels. You want to give a loan? That's great. Take his passport. Take his Tudat Zehut. We had in Shul a month ago. I was learning with someone before davening. A guy comes in and says, I want to daven in the minyan upstairs. Can I borrow tefillin? So I said, okay, we have a gemach of tefillin in the shul. Who are you? So he said, I'm visiting here. You know, I asked you a shaila a few weeks ago, last time I visited here. So I said, fine, you could borrow the tefillin, but leave me your tudat zehut. So he said, my tudat zehut's in the car. The rabbi of the shul doesn't trust me? This is the biggest insult I've had. You know what a tough life I've had, and you don't trust me? Now, there were other people there, and he's starting to cry, literally tears. And I said to him, it's nothing personal. It's not my tefillin. It's tefillin that belongs to the gemach of the shul. If you want to borrow them, you have to give me your tudat zehut. You want? You have a cell phone? Leave me your cell phone. So the guy's crying, and he's containing himself from cursing me out. I got to hear later that he didn't say such nice things about me. But you know what? That's his problem. It's not my tefillin. And tefillin do cost over 1,000 shekel. And I don't know who the guy is. I didn't ask him anything insulting. All I said was, I don't know you. Leave me some kind of collateral. So the guy chose to take it personally. That's unfortunately his problem. I'm not telling you I felt so good about it. It's not a good feeling when a guy starts crying at you and yelling at you and he's all insulted, but that doesn't make him right. We had a guy come to yeshiva and tell us he has to buy tefillin for his son, and his son's going to be bar mitzvah tomorrow, and he just needs a loan to get him over this bump, and he knows that the Jewish people are kind people. And I said, fine. So they came to me. Everyone was scared of telling him no. So I said, okay, ask him where his son goes to school. I want to talk to his son's Rebbe. I want to know where he works. I want his tudat zehut until he pays back the loan. I want post-dated checks. If his whole story is valid. So again, I got the same rant in the base medrash. A rabbi doesn't trust me. This is such a chutzpah. Why should I trust him? I don't know who he is. He walked in off the street, never met the guy. So we don't have to be stupid. We have a mitzvah to give loans. We don't have a mitzvah to be stupid. You want to give a loan? Good. You should give a loan. It's a mitzvah. But do it intelligently and protect yourself. There's no reason not to take collateral. A guy wants to take a loan. Okay, no problem. So give me your iPhone. Give me some kind of collateral. The Torah tells us when we take collateral, be careful, because if you take collateral that he needs, like you took his blanket, you got to bring it back every night. You can't leave him in a state where he can't sleep at night because he doesn't have a blanket. If he calls to me, Hashem says, I will listen. Ah, so the Chafetz Chaim says, so that means that when you give a loan, you're going to go there every night to give him back the blanket. Come back every morning and take the blanket, or he's going to come to you, right, to take and pick up the blanket. So then, what kind of collateral is it? He has it every night, right? Says the Chafetz Chaim, yeah, but the idea that he has to go back and forth every day, that's an annoyance. That's going to get him to pay up. The Torah warns us not to curse the leaders. The Torah warns us to give our tithe, our truma and maestros on time. We have a mitzvah when an animal is born, you give it 7 days, and on the eighth day it can be brought to the temple. It can be brought as a sacrifice. We have a prohibition not to take God's name in vain. We have a prohibition not to be false witnesses. We have a special mitzvah when it comes to court. So here we have very interesting halachos. Number one, if the court is going to execute someone, so then they have to have a majority that's greater than one. They can't have a majority of only one. Number two, if the courts... You'll ask me how, you should always have a majority that's greater than one, and the answer is that sometimes you can abstain. What happens if the whole court decides he's guilty? Then he doesn't get the death penalty.
He's not guilty.
He doesn't get the death penalty. Why? The Torah gives...
Isn't that amazing?
Why? It's an interesting concept. Can't be that no one found something good to say about him. There must have been an angle, and if everyone found him guilty, then there's something wrong here.
So if I've ever... Court, I gotta make my case so bad that everyone
thinks. The death penalty. We're talking about death penalty here. I wouldn't play that game, you know. Why not? Yeah, why not? Yeah. We have a special mitzvah not to give a poor person extra credit in his argument. He's coming to court, you got to treat the poor and the wealthy equally. Justice has to be honest. Now, as much as justice has to be honest, we still try to find a middle ground. The first thing a court will do is talk to the two sides and say, maybe we could find a compromise. The mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. Okay, so you find the lost object, you have a mitzvah of giving it back. So now you're going to spend your whole day picking up pens in the Beis Medrash and giving them back. No, you can't do that. You can't spend your whole day picking up pens and giving them back. Most people aren't too interested in their pens. So it has to be something of value. Today we don't value pens. The average pen is not of value. But you do come across things that people lost and you give them back. What happens? You posted a sign, 30 days have passed. What are you going to do? Our house, we keep finding things. One day we find a sweater, a woman's sweater. How often? You know, this was back in the day when only Mechon Meir guys came. We couldn't figure out who left the sweater by us. So we didn't even know where to post. You know, so you post a sign outside the house. We didn't know who came. We didn't know who left the sweater. Yeah. So what can you do? So you take a picture. You take a digital picture of the simanim, of the signs. And basically what you say is, look, this sweater is valued at 50 shekel. If the person ever turns up and tells me, hey, I left the sweater by you, I'll ask him for a sign. If he could tell me the sign, I'll pay for the sweater. Meanwhile, I'll give it to someone else to enjoy. I'll use it. Someone else will use it. I can't have my house being a storage bin for other people's objects. But what happens if you find gold earrings or gold cufflinks? Doesn't take too much to store them. You put them in an envelope somewhere. You write down the date you found it, where you found it, and you hold on to it. There's nothing wrong. And a person would much rather have his gold earrings or gold cufflinks than the value. They want what's theirs. So here we have to discern. There are objects where the person isn't so interested. He doesn't care if he gets that sweater or not back. He doesn't mind getting the value, and it's a big hassle to take care of it. Then there are objects where the person really wants his back. You should try to give him back his own object. Yes? I didn't say it ever becomes hefker. If the object has a simon, if the object has something that identifies it, why would it become hefker? On the other side, you can't hold on to it forever. Yes?
So the stuff that's left in our rooms...
So the public institution, and I made my house like a public institution, you know, public institution should put a sign on the door that says, when you enter our domain, it's with the understanding that any object that's left behind after 30 days is ours. We can do whatever we want with it. If you don't want to go by these rules, don't come in. You don't even have to write that final line. That's understood. So public domains, like the yeshiva, has a few signs like that around the yeshiva. In our shul, we have a few signs like that. And that absolves us. Then we say, after 30 days, you came in with that understanding. So all the coats and jackets and everything else that was left behind are ours. Because that's what the sign says. You have 30 days to pick up any object that's left behind. And then it's up to us, to our discretion, to do what we'd like. And the yeshiva, I think, has the same thing. Look around. If I remember correctly, there was a sign on the front doors.
So the stuff that was left in our rooms, we have to bring it to... What should we do with it?
Ask them. Ask them. The Machon for sure has a policy. We have a warning not to take bribes. Sometimes a person says, I know what I'm going to rule anyways. No, Torah says no. We have mitzvah of Shemitah. So this mitzvah is coming up. Next year is going to be Shemitah. We're up to the sixth year, meaning this coming Rosh Hashanah is going to be Shemitah, which means that all Jewish owners of land are not allowed to work the land. So where do we get fruits and vegetables from? So, slowly. Wait. First thing is we have certain orchards that grow on their own. You know, estrogen will grow on their own. You'll have estrogen. This year isn't the problem, right? Hopefully the estrogen you'll pick before Rosh Hashanah. But the grapes and the oranges and the peaches and the plums and the nectarines, they all grow on their own. If you take care of the field, you'll get more. If you don't take care of the field, you'll get less. But they grow on their own. So now we're all allowed to go in and pick those fruits. What the rabbis saw in the period of the Second Temple was that people weren't doing that. They weren't letting others go into the fields and pick their own fruits. So the rabbis instituted something called Otzar Bezdin, where the courts would come in with their own workers, and they would pick all the fruits off the trees, and then they'd open up their own warehouses and say, we're giving out the fruits for free, so whoever wants can come take them. But the rabbis have to cover their own cost, meaning the courts that have hired workers to pick all the fruit, and they rented out this warehouse, so then they would give it at cost. So till today, the courts do that. You have many fields that will call the courts, either the court of Rav Nissim Karelitz or other courts. They establish the Otzar Bezdin, where they come in with their workers, they harvest all the fruit, they don't take care of the field, because you're not allowed to take care of a field on Shemitah, but they harvest all the fruits, and then they sell it at cost, where basically they're saying, you just got to cover our cost. You're not paying for the fruit, you're paying for the labor. You're paying for the worker we hired, the trucks we hired, the warehouse we hired, and then the fruits come out much cheaper. Now, here in the neighborhood, you'll see that there are many places, different homes, that will sell fruits once a week. You could come in and you buy them by the bushel or by the box. You don't. Chazal didn't want us to have commerce. It shouldn't look like you're selling fruits of Shavia, so you can't weigh it. You buy a bag of grapes, a bag of apples. It doesn't go by weight because you're not really paying for the fruit. You're paying for the labor. So that's how many places will work. It's interesting that there is an Otzar Bezdin that's very common around here, where they will let you weigh it, and they will let you, they work, they have other leniencies. But it's not ideal. The ideal way is like we described, and there are Otzar Bezdin all around. What we have to know is that the fruit is holy. The fruit of Shemitah is holy fruit. It's fruit from the mitzvah of Shemitah. According to Nachmanides, you'd even make a special blessing on eating this fruit. The fact that we don't, halachically, but that's the idea. The fact that that the fruit is holy has halachic implications. The Torah says you must eat the fruit. So if you bought a banana, you ate half of it, now you don't feel like eating the other half, you got to feed the other half to someone else, one of your kids or something, or eat it later. You're not allowed to just throw it in the garbage. You're not allowed to destroy fruit of Shemitah. So what happens if you ate an apple and you're one of those finicky people who don't finish the apple down to the core? You eat the apple and then you leave enough where someone else might still eat that apple. So then you've left a lot of pulp on the apple. So if you can eat it, good. If you don't want to eat it, what we do is we put it in a separate bag. We don't put it in the regular garbage. And then after a day or two that it rots, so then it loses the holiness of Shemitah fruit, and you can put it in the regular garbage. So what ends up happening is, in the average home that has Shemitah fruit, we have a few bags, because the bag I put in yesterday's apple core is already half rotten. If I'm going to throw in today's apple core, I'm basically destroying today's apple core. I'm not allowed to do that. Just like I can't put it in the garbage, I can't put it in yesterday's bag. So you end up having three baskets, one from 3 days ago, from 2 days ago, one from yesterday, right? Or from 2 days ago, yesterday, and today. And each one, once it gets bad, you throw it in the garbage. You close the bag, put it in the garbage. So it gets a little tricky because, you have flies that like these. So the trick is to keep these little bins outside the window. Meaning you, so we don't feed stuff that's humanly edible, you don't feed them to animal. Where it gets tricky is like Havdalah. You want the cup to overflow, you're not allowed to waste the grape juice of Shemitah. So during the Shemitah year, if you're going to have grape juice from Shemitah, you can't have the cup overflow.
Is
extra holy. It's very special. It's like Shabbat.
Okay, so you can use other grape juice. You could buy, like they said, Turkish grape juice. Okay, so we covered a lot of the parsha. If we have time, then Bezachim on Thursday we'll get back to more.